from the heart of our nation's capital, this is Washington Watch Weekend Edition. Now, here's your host, David Salkeld.
Greetings, fellow patriots. I am David Salkeld, and I'm a constitutional conservative, husband, and homeschool dad. From the public school system to the Korean Peninsula to the Rose Garden at the White House, it was an historic week this past week, and we want to share just some of the highlights. Millions of people across the nation gathered for the 35th annual National Day of Prayer on Thursday. The event focused on praying for the unity of America. We were privileged to have Counselor to the President Kellyanne Conway join Tony on Thursday to talk about the prayer event that was held in the Rose Garden of the White House. Here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Kellyanne, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hi, Tony. How are you?
I'm great. I was just telling our listeners about today's event in the Rose Garden, and the highlight for me was this: when the president brought John Ponder and Richard Beasley onto the stage. What an illustration of religious freedom to be able to live out your faith in such a way that it impacts the lives of others.
Well, there's no question, and I really hope, Tony, at some point people will take 20, 30 minutes out of their day and go back and watch that entire event. How beautiful it was to have the Christian choir there opening up the event, and then you had six faith leaders all representing different faiths come to the podium and offer prayers. And then, of course, the vice president and the president. And this is something that's been important to President Trump since he got elected, and certainly before he got elected. On the campaign, he made very clear he would be a friend to people of faith, a defender of religious liberty. He'd be pro-life, and indeed he's delivered on all of that. And you saw that in sharp relief. You also saw a president who genuinely enjoys himself when he is able to host the National Day of Prayer in the Rose Garden. It was a very exciting day for him, and he went to Reverend Graham's funeral in North Carolina a few months ago. He and the First Lady visited him as he lied in state because he knows that this is a nation that has as its core prayerfulness.
Kellyanne, tell our listeners about the president's announcement today about the Faith Initiative.
Sure. So the president today signed an executive order on the establishment of a White House Faith and Opportunity Initiative. And the reason he did this is because he wants the public and this office to provide recommendations on the administration's policy agenda affecting faith-based and community programs. And in so much of the work we do here, Tony, we see that how important it is that these decades-old faith-based organizations are in us helping to find solutions to help Americans. It really is amazing for us to be able to tap into that. So also in this this office, he wants recommendations on programs and policies where we can effectively start to bend the curve in the right direction on poverty. And he also wants us to understand if there are any failures where we're trying to protect religious liberty under the law and to reduce burdens overall in the exercise of free religion. So this also creates a White House Faith and Opportunity Initiative within the Executive Office of the President. He wants it here where he is. We'll have a new advisor to the White House on Faith and Opportunity. And all executive departments and agencies that do not have Centers for Faith and Opportunity initiatives currently will designate a liaison to the initiative. Essentially, this is the way to protect conscience, to protect religious freedom and liberty, and to really advocate for what we all know is the center of our nation and its founding, and that's prayerfulness and faith.
Kellyanne, before I let you go, I just want to ask you one question on an issue that you're very much involved in, passionate about, and it's the opioid crisis. And I have to say that I would not think that there's a place where the faith community can play a more significant role than in that.
You're right, and to their enormous credit, Tony, they're already there. They've been playing a role. They've been on the front lines of different public health crises and crises of morality, frankly, in this country for decades. And so they are frontline players in this. I've gone around the country. I've met with a number of faith-based employers, faith-based organization leaders, and they're there to help. They're coordinating and communicating with and solving these problems with our local law enforcement and other federal interdiction partners. They also are talking to health professionals. Of course, they administer to those who are already addicted. They're trying to break down the stigma and the silence for those who may need help and are afraid to speak up. They're coordinating with fire stations. Do you know in some of our counties around this country, Tony, a fire station is four or five times more likely to respond to an overdose than to a fire. And so you see these faith-based leaders. This we call this the crisis next door because no state has been spared and no demographic group untouched. And we want people to know that, yes, there's treatment and recovery, there's prevention, education, there's interdiction and law enforcement, but that at the end of the day, we have to understand 174 of our brothers and sisters in this country die of drug overdoses every day. It's a leading cause of death over breast cancer, gun violence, and also plane crashes, for example, accidental death. So when you put it into that perspective, when you hear just the unbelievable numbers, you recognize there's a huge role for the faith-based organizations to play. And Tony, many people will tell you, oh, you know, why would a Republican conservative administration get involved with the drug crisis? We've been trying to do that for years. Bill Bennett had it right many years ago. You focus on this as a nation, you do a whole-of-government approach, all the while telling everybody, hey, he's the president, this is the White House, this is Washington, and we're leaning all the way in, but all the while making sure that people who are closest to those in need, which, of course, are our community-based, faith-based leaders. People closest to those in need know best how to administer to those needs, so we don't want to get in the way of that. In fact, Congress recently ponied up $6 billion for the opioid crisis. That's an historic amount of money, and it will go to treatment and recovery. It will go to law enforcement and interdiction. It will go to prevention and education. But we so appreciate the great work of the men and women in the faith-based community in helping to treat and to our brothers and sisters in need, but also to help our youth understand that they're worth more than some street drug they paid $5 or $10 for. They're worth more than that cocaine. They're worth more than that heroin or that meth. So the last thing I would tell you is it's incredibly important for people to realize opioid crisis is different. It may end with somebody in the back alley with a vein in his or her arm, but it begins often enough in our own medicine cabinets. And that tiny little bottle where the label bears the name of the local pharmacy and the family doctor is tricky. People think, hey, this is meant to help someone somehow. If I just take a little bit, it won't hurt me. And that's where the harm begins. So we all should be more aware, educate each other, know what fentanyl is, and don't be afraid to reach out and help each other. Thank you, Tony.
Kellyanne, thanks so much for being with us. Great to talk with you.
God bless you. Take care.
If you want to find out more about Kellyanne or the National Day of Prayer, head over to TonyPerkins.com and follow the links. Also, I want to invite you to be a part of keeping Washington Watch on the air by going to TonyPerkins.com and making a contribution. Again, that's TonyPerkins.com. Don't go away. We'll be right back with a look at a year of religious liberty.
Hello. Can you hear me? Are we losing our voice? 69% of American adults are using social media platforms to express themselves. But digital giants like Facebook, Google, and Twitter have collided with the free speech rights of citizen internet users. Family Research Council hosted an expert panel discussion on the question of losing our voices. Who owns free speech on the internet? To watch this discussion on one of the most important freedom of expression issues in decades, go to frc.org/voice.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm your host, David Salkeld. It was 1 year ago that President Trump signed his executive order on religious liberty, and on Thursday of this week, FRC's director of the Center for Religious Liberty, Travis Weber, joined Tony Perkins to talk about what effect the executive order had on religious liberty cases over the past year. Here's Tony Perkins.
Travis, welcome back.
Thank you, Tony.
You wrote a paper that was a report, I should say, that was released earlier this week. 1 year later, the impact of President Trump's executive order protecting religious liberty. What's it say?
Sure. So we go through the impact and the many ways that people may not be aware about the impact of the May 4th religious liberty executive order from last year. And basically, if we're going to sum this up, we can say that we now have at least 44 schools giving educations to 148,000 students that were involved in litigation that are better off now because of President Trump's action. In addition,
now, are these like colleges, universities?
Yeah, colleges, universities. These were involved in the HHS mandate litigation, objections to being forced to provide abortion-causing drugs and services
like
against
Oklahoma
their beliefs.
Wesleyan University,
Oklahoma
Dr.
Wesleyan.
Piper.
A number of schools. Yeah. Many people are not aware of the impact, the vast impact, and this does not even include the schools that may have had objections but not been part of the litigation.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a lot of groups that are protected here. at least groups serving up to 13.7 million people with health care and food, part of Catholic umbrella organizations, many of which involved in this litigation, not all, but all of them better off, more protected because of the HHS actions taken as a result of the executive order. And that's just one area. Executive orders impacted a number of areas. And this is all, you know, when we look at just the religious liberty implications of this one executive order.
Well, an area that you've been working with General Boykin and myself tracking for quite some time has been the military, which has been a, you know, a battleground when it comes to religious freedom in the last decade.
Very true. And one of the cases detailed, and folks can read more about it in our report, but a case of Colonel Bohannon. Colonel Bohannon did not want to sign a certificate of appreciation for a same-sex spouse. He said, look, we'll get this signed by someone else, right? So at that point, you would think, well, okay, everyone's happy here. Well, no. There was a complaint of discrimination filed against him. And ultimately, it took the Secretary of the Air Force Authority to rule for his in his favor, saying, look, his religious freedom law and policy demands that he be protected. And they cited the executive order and the DOJ guidance explaining the Religious Freedom Restoration Act framework that should be followed here. So that framework was followed. And when it was followed, he was protected. The person still got their certificate, and you have a win-win for all parties involved. So this is an example of the proper approach that we need to see implemented in other cases going forward still.
Which has been the standard historically is what we call accommodation, that people's religious beliefs and convictions should be accommodated. That's what the colonel was seeking. But under the Obama administration, there was no accommodation in many cases. In fact, there was either forced celebration and acceptance of something that ran counter to many people's moral and religious beliefs.
Yeah, it ultimately comes down to imposing a philosophy and ideology of, in their minds, there's no discrimination, end of story, which excludes entirely the First Amendment protections of free exercise of religion. And when this was applied to people like Colonel Bohannon, you're basically telling him there's no place for a Christian in the public square, in the military, be able to run a small business. It's essential that we get this right. And some of these agencies, the guidance is getting it right. There's still other guidance out there, which it'd be good to have clarification on the books to address issues that may arise. But Colonel Bohannon's case and that of Mr. Vanderboon are success stories at this point.
So, Travis Weber, 1 year after the president issued this executive order protecting religious liberty, has it done that?
It has protected religious liberty, and we're going to continue to strive for that to be protected and be vigilant about that going forward.
There's still cases out there. There's still policies in place that have yet to be brought in line with the executive order. I mean, we're still seeing some of that in the military, but we've changed directions.
We've changed directions, and we're coming back to a place of religion being acceptable as it should be in the public square in our country.
Now, that is good news. Travis Weber, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tony.
If you want to find out more about the Center for Religious Liberty, just head over to tonyperkins.com and follow the links. Also, a quick reminder that your generous contributions to Family Research Council enable us to continue making these programs available, and you can donate when you visit tonyperkins.com. We'll be right back with a look at the ending of hostilities in Korea.
Where is our country headed? Are we moving in the right direction? Mark your calendar for the Values Voter Summit on September 21st to 23rd in Washington, D.C. and join hundreds of Americans that want a culture in which human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. Past speakers include President Donald Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, House Speaker Paul Ryan, Kirk Cameron, Kellyanne Conway, Secretary Ben Carson, and Sean Hannity. Don't miss the early bird price of $99 at valuesvotersummit.org.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. Last week, North Korea's Kim Jong-un and South Korea's Moon Jae-in signed a declaration of peace, prosperity, and unification, signaling the end of hostilities on the Korean Peninsula. On Wednesday, Southeast Asia expert Gordon Chang joined Family Research Council President Tony Perkins to discuss the events in Korea.
Gordon, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Oh, thank you so much, Tony.
All right, Gordon, what are we seeing? Something historic here?
Well, certainly something historic. And we've had one historic event after another for the last 12 or 13 days, starting with North Korea's announcement of a suspension of missile and nuke testing and the closing of their site at Punggye-ri, which is where they've detonated all six of their devices. Really what we're seeing right now is the result of a more muscular U.S. policy. Not only have there been threats on North Korea, but more important, the Trump administration has imposed unilateral sanctions and gone to the U.N. and toughened the sanctions from that body. So that has convinced the North Koreans that they've got to come to terms with the United States. That's a good development. There can be a lot of backsliding, of course. This is North Korea, after all. But nonetheless, we now have a pathway to an enduring solution.
I mean, I think, yeah, I would be skeptical if we were talking about one or two concessions that they're making. But, I mean, to see him along with the South Korean president and that agreement that they signed and their time together, the photo op, all of that – and then, you know, the releasing of these three prisoners, which have been an issue of contention for quite some time, suggested he really does, I think, want to come to the table and have a positive outcome with Donald Trump.
Yes, what's really stunning is that he apparently said to Moon Jae-in, the South Korean president, that there were only two things that he wanted for him to give up his nuclear arsenal. One of them was a pledge by the United States not to attack North Korea. And the other thing is the United States to sign a peace treaty to formally end the Korean War, turning the armistice into a permanent solution. If we had come to that after 5 years of negotiation, we would call that a major victory. But to get to that position where Kim would say that before he even meets President Trump really is quite stunning. Now, of course, We should have a lot of skepticism about what Kim's plans ultimately are. But what he's done is he's created a marker by which President Trump can hold him accountable. And that is, I think, what we're seeing right now. The United States has the leverage to push North Korea in ways that it doesn't want to go. And so all I'm asking is for the president, our president, to make sure that he does use the elements of American power to make sure that we do get the disarmament of North Korea and some of the other things which are essential for us.
Now, Gordon, he's as I understand, he's said he's welcomed the international community to come in and inspect the fact that they are disassembling their nuclear program.
Yes. Well, what they're doing right now is pulling the cabling out of the tunnels. They have invited the United States to witness the decommissioning of the site. That's good. We saw something similar in 2008 when his father, Kim Jong-il, blew up the cooling tower for their only reactor. And then the year after that, they walked away from the six-party talks. Now, it's up to President Trump to make sure that they don't use that playbook this time, that they don't backtrack on their promises. But I think that President Trump understands that. He's got a national security advisor who isn't going to take very much guff from the North Koreans. That's a good thing.
Gordon Chang, we're a long ways from where we were just 3 months ago in terms of the relationships between the United States, North Korea, and South Korea. Does President Trump deserve some credit in this?
Oh, well, certainly. President Trump is the one thing, one reason why a decade-long status quo, which was really frozen, was broken up. Andrei Longkov, who is a leading North Korea expert, he's based in South Korea, has basically said, look, the reason why we are at this place is because China, North Korea, and South Korea changed their policies dramatically at the end of last year. And the reason they changed their policies was because they were all afraid of going to war. Now, Longkov didn't say this, but of course, the only reason why those countries thought that there could be a war is because of what Trump was doing. And so clearly, those threats, along with the sanctions enforcement, which I mentioned, were what got us to this place. We've got a long way to go, Tony, but, you know, at this particular time, things are moving in the right direction.
Very, very good. Gordon Chang, 60 seconds. I want to ask one final question. Is there a connection between the Iran nuclear deal that the president is looking at in terms of nixing or modifying and North Korea? Two separate issues, or is there a connection?
Oh, there's definitely a connection. Both the Iranian and the North Korean nuclear weapons program are joined at the hip. Some people say that it's one program in two separate locations. The Iranians pay the North Koreans somewhere between $2.5 to $3 billion a year. So, you know, there's no question that they're connected. And President Trump going after the Iran nuclear deal of 2015 does have an effect on the North Koreans.
Gordon Chang, as always, great to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Tony.
If you want to find out more about Gordon Chang, head on over to TonyPerkins.com and follow the links. Also, I want to invite you to be a part of keeping Washington Watch on the air by going to TonyPerkins.com and making a contribution. Again, that's TonyPerkins.com. Don't go away. We'll be right back with a look at education testing that might shock you.
Who is speaking up for Christians in Washington, D.C.? For over 35 years, Family Research Council has been your voice for advancing faith, family, and freedom in public policy and culture from a Christian worldview in our nation's capital. Stand with us as we defend the truth and preserve the vision that our founding fathers had for this country. To learn more about FRC, go to FRC.org and follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest news.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm your host, David Salkeld. According to the National Assessment of Educational Progress test results released by the Department of Education, 65% of 8th graders in American public schools in 2017 were not proficient in reading, and 67% were not proficient in math. Joining Tony to talk about the findings is the editor-in-chief of CNS News, Terry Jeffrey.
Terry, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, Tony. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Obviously, this was something that was shocking to you. You wrote about it. You pull them back the numbers. The numbers tell a pretty frightening story.
It is. It's a very sad story. And this is one thing, actually, that the Federal Department of Education does that I think is worthwhile. Periodically, they give these National Assessment of Educational Progress tests in basic subjects like math and reading to public school and private school students all around the country. And the latest were the reading and math tests given last year, as you mentioned. And it's really remarkable. They've now published the results. And as you said, 67% of the 8th graders in public schools in the United States were not proficient in math. 65% were not proficient in reading. And, Tony, when you look at some specific urban jurisdictions, for example, Detroit, in the city of Detroit, in the public schools, only 5% of the 8th graders were proficient in math, and only 7% were proficient in reading. So 93% of the kids who go through 8 years in public schools in the city of Detroit are not taught to be proficient in reading by the public schools there.
Well, if my reading is correct, it looks like my home state didn't do too well in math. Among the states, Louisiana public elementary schools did the worst in teaching students math. What explanations are being given?
Well, you know, for one thing, these tests have not gotten a lot of publicity, and that does not surprise me. I don't think the liberal press wants to talk about it, but you're right. In Louisiana, in the public schools in Louisiana, only 19% of the 8th graders were proficient in math, which made it the 50th of all 50 states. New Mexico was the second worst, with 20% being proficient in math. You know, I think it's pretty obvious that the public schools in this country are not working at teaching the basic things that a kid needs to learn in school. Now, personally, I believe there's two parts of an education and they're integrated. One part is learning information, learning how to do mathematics, learning how to read, and then learning mm-hmm. the basics of Western civilization and the basics
right.
of math and science and technology once you have those basic skills. But the other side of it, in my view, Tony, is that schools need to instill values in children. We need a certain amount of virtue in a country in order for a republic to be maintained. And the public schools as we've moved forward in time, have moved further and further and further away from that mission. In fact, I think in a lot of ways, they're working against it by teaching kids that are wrong. So I believe we're at a point in American history where we have public schools that aren't effectively teaching kids basics like reading and writing, but on the other side, they're teaching them things that are wrong. And this needs to be fixed.
I could not agree more. What they're actually doing is they're taking away from those core educational components that are needed, increasingly needed, I should say, in a global economy. And they're replacing them with something that actually attacks those virtues you talked about. I mean, we just had last week the sex ed sit out day, when we're looking at this graphic material that is being given to our children on sex ed. We spend more time talking about gender, you know, what gender they want to be, and all of the sexual agenda of the Human Rights Campaign and Planned Parenthood, and the test results show what's happening as a result of that.
Right. If you are traditional parents and you're trying to raise your kids to believe in the traditional and correct understanding of what is right and wrong, you're going to be at war with the public school in your community more likely than not. If a kid comes from a broken family where his father has gone away and deserted him, or he doesn't have a mother, and his family is not instilling in those values, he's going to be taught the wrong things by the public schools. And my view is the way to fix this is to have universal school choice. The liberals don't want it. The Republicans don't talk about it enough. But I looked at I looked for my syndicated column, not my news story, at the amount of money that is spent by state and local governments on public schools in America. And when you do the math, it's more than $610 billion in the latest year they have available, 2015. Well, what it boils down to is, in this country, where the government, state and local government, is spending more than $13,000 per pupil for elementary and high schools. If you gave every parent in this country who has a kid in grammar school or high school a voucher for $13,000, they could get a good education for their child outside the public school system.
Well, maybe they're hoping most of those parents went to the public schools and can't do the math.
Right.
Terry Jeffrey, as always, great to talk with you. And again, I appreciate the stuff you do because you focus on that stuff that nobody else is covering, which is so, so important. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tony.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. I'm David Salkeld, thanking you for being with us, and I encourage you to be back here next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
Washington Watch Weekend Edition is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.